You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. ...8:05 on a Tuesday. We continue. My guest this morning is Matt Morgan, Lieutenant Colonel type, infantry and public affairs guy in the United States Marine Corps, now retired. He got into the consulting business, working out of the public affairs officer office in Los Angeles, and that has taken him into the film business. So, Matt, email question. Hey, Mac, is this what he does full-time? So, Matt, is this what you do full-time?
It is what I do full-time. I, you know, retired from the Marine Corps, and I had, you know, an amazing wife who, you know, we had probably a dozen moves together. And when I got ready to retire, I was making that decision of, do I stay in the Norfolk, Virginia area, or Northern Virginia, and work in the defense sector, or do I do what I've always wanted to do, which is to become a filmmaker? And my wife said, you know, you've put your dream on hold long enough. There's no reason to stay here. Let's take this retirement income. She owns her own business. She can, you know, really run it from anywhere. And so we decided to move up to Northern Michigan and give me the opportunity to pursue the dream.
Hey, Matt, I want to talk to you about that and post-combat related mental health. The more I do this show, the more I believe that having your passion as part of your work life is important for post-combat related mental health, because you get up in the morning and there's days that you can't wait to go to work, to get out of bed early some days to go do it, and your mind's occupied by this future that you have. Talk about that. I mean, do you agree with that? Because if you don't, the alternative is you go to work, your mind's not occupied, you don't love it, and you're going there for a paycheck. I think it's a big component of post-combat related mental health.
Well, the first thing I'll say is transition is hard. It was a lot harder than I expected it to be. When we made the decision to move, I knew I was moving to an area that did not have a connection to the Defense Department at all, much less a connection to the United States Marine Corps. So it's a place where if people ask you, you say, well, I retired from the Marine Corps, their eyes kind of glaze over. You've got virtually nobody that you can relate to. And so family becomes really critical and important to that. But the other side of me choosing this course was that, having been a public affairs officer in the United States Marine Corps, certainly came with its share of headaches. But the greatest thing about being a public affairs officer in the Marine Corps is you get to tell the Marine Corps story. You get to be out there all the time, you know, pointing out the amazing achievements of U.S. Marines throughout history and the modern, you know, today. And it's an amazingly rewarding job in that sense. But if I was going to make a transition to doing that, like public relations in the civilian sector, I just couldn't see how I could maintain my enthusiasm for working for a big oil company and doing that same job. So it was essential, I think, to my mental health that I'd be doing something that I really loved and believed in. And I still get to do that today. I mean, even though I'm working as a freelance producer, I've got other projects that I'm working on, and they're all connected by the common thread of telling stories about the types of individuals who don't seek honor for their achievements, who don't seek attention. And that's one of the reasons why I love the story about Harold Schultz so much. So, I think it's critical. You have to love what you do, because it's going to return gratification to you in ways that just chasing a dollar couldn't.
The more, you know, as you say those things about telling the Marine Corps story, that's what I get to do on a daily basis. And I can't tell you how gratifying it is. The stories that you hear blow you away. I mean, just again, last week to interview a 91-year-old PFC squad leader from Iwo Jima, and then the next hour to interview a major at the Chosen Reservoir tanker. And you know what? I looked on Google Earth. This is what a nerd I've become. But I went on Google Earth to find to trace the path that they took out of the Chosen Reservoir. And it wasn't apparent to me when they headed for the coast. And I'm like, well, what route would they have? Because the terrain is so jacked up and you're looking at it going, well, they couldn't have gone that way. Well, sure as hell, that's the way they went. And you're looking at it on Google Earth going, the division went that way. It's crazy. And so the more you tell the story and you talk to these guys and they come on and they're very matter of fact about what they did, and yet you know the epic that they participated in, it just blows you away. And it's just then they come home and they go back to work and they resume their lives and whatnot. So I get to tell that story every day. And I can tell you, I remember somebody asking me, well, do you think there's enough content, you know, to go on the air every day? I'm like, hello? Yeah. Do you know? Have you ever told the story? And I hadn't told it like you had, Matt. But the story is so incredible. And, you know, what they do after they get off active duty is almost as impressive as what they do on active duty. So.
Right. Well, and you know, you mentioned that you talked to Sebastian Younger, and I've worked on a project here locally that was inspired by some of his work, you know, which is this notion that combat veterans talk to other combat veterans in ways that they don't talk to the general public. And having the opportunity to have those conversations in ways where others can eavesdrop is a great opportunity to share what the combat experience means in ways that most Americans would never have the chance to access.
It's interesting that you use the word eavesdrop, because when I first started doing this, I was doing a radio show up on the Minnesota-North Dakota border in a town of about 100,000 people. And that's how people described it. You're having a conversation with a buddy of yours, and we get to eavesdrop on it. It's like we're sitting behind you eavesdropping on your conversation that you and he are sitting there having, but it's something we would never be privy to otherwise.
Right. And I think, you know, your interview with Carl Marlanis the other day highlighted that, in that, you know, he was able to share his experience in a way that was intimate. You know, it's not the type of thing that you normally stand up and would tell a room full of people, because it would be considered attention seeking or blowing your own horn. It's the type of thing that can only happen in the confines of an intimate conversation. And then that's what this certainly offers. You know, you're always aware there are other people listening, but you certainly can go places, when you're just having a conversation between friends or at least individuals who share the common experience of the Marine Corps.
Matt Morgan, our guest here, he the producer of The Unknown Flag Raiser of Iwo Jima, and it is appearing on the Smithsonian Channel. I've got an email for you. You know, Matt, I was watching the documentary, and the numbers of casualties I've heard, you know, for years, approximately 7,000 killed, approximately 20,000 wounded. I started doing some math. If there's 3,000 plus in a regiment, 7,000 is the equivalent of two infantry regiments killed in action. 20,000 is approximately seven infantry regiments of wounded. If you total it, the approximately nine infantry regiments is the equivalent of the entire division killed or wounded at Camp Pendleton today. That's a pretty astounding number, and it took me quantifying it like that really for it to register in terms of the level of violence at close quarters that Marines experienced on Iwo Jima. Please thank Mr. Morgan for his work. I loved it. I'll watch it again. I think it's a huge contribution to the history of the Marine Corps in terms of revalidating the sacrifice of Marine Corps veterans of World War II and also getting the story right. I found it interesting and probably completely in character with what he did, that there was no photograph of Mr. Schultz post-World War II. Can you talk about that? That sounds crazy. How do you not have your picture taken at a 4th of July, or how is there, you know, that sounds crazy to me.
Well, Harold was, by all accounts, he kept to himself. He never married. The one woman who he did have a relationship with after the war died tragically. And so he just essentially went on with his life working as a mail sorter. Did not seem that he had any real close friends, certainly no close family. So there was no one, I guess, around to make his picture. It's noteworthy because we have two photos of Harold that were taken, probably somewhere at a studio around the Laguna area, which is where, a lot of the Marines went on liberty for 5th Marine Division, at Camp Pendleton. And Harold had two photos taken. One was, he was still a private, and it's probably taken shortly after the 5th Marine Division got their patch approved and issued. So he would have had that sewn on his alphas and sat for a picture. And then shortly thereafter, we have another photo of him after he'd been promoted to PFC. So once he got his mosquito wings, he went right out and got a picture taken. But those are the only two we have. And at no point after the war did he ever sit down for a portrait of any kind for any reason that we could determine. You know, his Purple Heart citation was folded up in a shoebox along with his Purple Heart. He never really shared that with anybody. So it's indicative of the type of man that he was. He just really kept to himself and never really wanted to revisit that part of his life.
You know, and when you sit down and consider those pieces, that it, you know, no image of him survives, that he went back to work and lived by himself and in Los Angeles as a mail sorter, it's completely in character for him. Not, you know, the last thing he would have wanted was the publicity associated with that flag raising.
Right. Well, I think that none of the men that we could tell really were looking forward to this Bond tour. It's been said that Rennie Gagnon was the one who actually enjoyed the attention, and that may very well be possible. But at the same time, these guys were being put on the road and put out there every single day. I can certainly imagine that under those circumstances, Schultz wouldn't have wanted that attention. And it really, by the time that this happened, he's wounded and laid up in a hospital. So there wasn't really an opportunity for him to step forward unless he would have made an issue of it.
Which he would have never done.
Which he did. There's no indication, right, that given his character, that he would have done that. And I know that there were Marines who did, and Charlie Niemeyer, the historian for the Marine Corps, has talked a lot about the fact that several Marines tried to come forward in the years since to say, no, they got that wrong, that was me there. But Harold was not one of those guys. Actually, it goes back to the early conversations that I had with Dr. Niemeyer, in that he said, listen, Matt, every day I get another letter from another individual. Do you know, have any idea how many people have come forward saying they were in the photo? And I said, yeah, but that's what's amazing about this, is that this guy never did. Not once did he ever try to step forward and claim his place in that image. And that's what makes him a more compelling figure and makes the whole thing a far more interesting story.
I've got a question for you. The Commandant chose his words very carefully. When he's interviewed in the documentary, he says, we believe that there's a very high probability that is Harold Schultz. Talk to me about that. Why did he state it in those terms?
Well, we obviously, the interview with the Commandant was longer than what ended up in the documentary. And he, you know, spoke about it in a few different ways. From that perspective, he was talking specifically about the panel's finding. Going back to 1946, then Commandant Vandegrift directed that the Marine Corps review the identity of one Marine whose identity had been disputed. And that was, you know, Ira Hayes had raised the flag saying that that's not Hank Hansen at the foot of the pole, that's Harlan Block, my fire team leader. And so in 1946, when the Marine Corps finally was compelled to take a look at that, the panel, the board itself, really only looked at that one individual in the photo. They didn't question or otherwise, you know, look into who everybody else was. They just accepted that as fact. And so when Dr. Niemeyer went to the commandant with the information that we had provided, his recommendation was, we're being given an opportunity here to reexamine the photo in total. Let's look at every single figure in this image and reaffirm his identity. So they went through each individual in the photo and ascribed not only an identity, but to a degree of certitude. And so there were percentages, I think, is how they handled it.
Okay.
And so that's why essentially the commandant's conclusion was that the board said, we think that it's highly probable that this is in fact Harold Schultz. So, and the commandant was choosing his words very carefully because he was very conscious of the message that he was sending to Marines. You know, there was even a discussion at one point of whether the commandant would speak specifically to Marines on this matter in a venue separate from the documentary itself, because they felt that it was extremely important for Marines to understand that while identifying Schultz was a matter of keeping faith and getting it right from a historical perspective, it didn't really matter to Marines that who these guys were, because the image is much bigger than just, you know, six individuals. You know, I've never said this on any other program or interview that I've done, but I constantly think to compare this to the culture that we see today playing out in the Navy SEAL community, where, you know, it's like, hey, I'm the guy who shot Bin Laden. And I think things like that, I think Marines understand that just because you happen to be the guy standing at the top of the stairs and have the opportunity to drill the guy when he steps out of his bedroom, doesn't, just being the trigger puller doesn't put you or set you apart from the thousands of other people that played a role in putting you in the spot to pull that trigger. And, you know, James Bradley, or John Bradley himself on the Bond tour, said it several times that it didn't matter who the six men were who raised that flagpole, because every man on Iwo Jima had a flag on that pole in some way or another.
My guest is Matt Morgan. And I'll tell you what, that's a whole interesting show, because if you follow it all, that the controversy surrounding the Navy SEALs and their quest for individual publicity, it runs completely counter to the culture that they ascribe to as this horizontal team. And so they are a community that is having quite the debate about how they should behave. And within the last year, there's been a number of different leadership directives relative to the Navy SEALs and urging them to get back to what their traditions are and what they've always been, which is, swift, silent, and deadly. So, interesting, Matt.
It goes to the point, you know, at several of the buildings at Joint Special Operations Command and one of the buildings at Damneck, there is a sign over the entrance, and it's a line from Faust. It says, "The deed is all and not the glory." And, you know, that's a particular mindset that puts, you know, the success of the team and the mission ahead of the individual glory. And I keep going to the fact that that is exactly the kind of individual that Harold Schultz epitomizes. He knew, he understood somehow intrinsically, whether he read his Goethe or not, he knew, you know, that it was more important what had happened there than whether or not he received the attention.
Harold Schultz, the unknown flag raiser of Iwo Jima. The commandant does say in your documentary, quote, "This doesn't change what they did, and then he goes on to say, and what they represented. So he does make that point in the documentary that about what that image symbolizes, no matter who's in it. And you and I talked last week about you know the thing with Bradley, and I've got an email to this. Mac, who originally identifies Bradley as being in the photo? So, Matt, who identifies Bradley originally?
Rainey Gagnon, the Easy Company runner. It wasn't until nearly a month after the flag had been raised. So the flag was raised on February 23rd, and it's almost a month later, on March 20th, the Headquarters Marine Corps sends a directive back to 5th Marine Division ordering that the flag raisers be identified. And so the 5th Marine Division public affairs officer handed that to a combat correspondent who went out to the regiment, and they hunted down. They knew that the company runner, Rainey Gagnon, had been tasked with carrying the second flag up to the top of Suribachi. He was already on his way up there with some batteries for the radio. And so they gave him this second larger flag and said, when you get up there, put that up. And so they knew that he'd been given that, so they asked him to identify the individuals. And he initially only identified five. Among them were John Bradley, rather. And what's interesting is that he identifies Bradley as being on the back with his helmet just visible. And so it's around the 7th of April when Gagnon gets back to the United States. The division drops him off on Eniwetok, and he catches a plane, goes back to Washington. And on the 7th of April, he sits down at the Navy Annex in Washington with the director of Marine Corps Public Relations at the time and his executive officer. And they look at the photo. And this is the first time Rainey Gagnon has seen the actual photo in its native format, rather than a newspaper clipping. And he's asked to identify the men. And he names five again, but he names them in a different order. And this time he actually puts Bradley as the second from the back, with the Garand rifle hanging from his shoulder, puts himself on the far side of the flagpole, and then puts Franklin Sousley next to him, which is in the position where we have him today. And so the colonel points out the man he's identified as Bradley is carrying a rifle. And they all agree that the corpsman would have been carrying a rifle, so he must have it backwards. And so they flip them. And then the colonel points out that he's named only five, but there's six men in the photo. And at that time, Rainey Gagnon reluctantly identifies the sixth man as Ira Hayes. So, but they're still, at this point, kind of all mixed up in the wrong position, because he has Mike Strank at the back where you can see him. He has Ira Hayes on the far side where only his hands are visible. So really, he has everybody but himself in the wrong positions, to include having misidentified Harlan Block as Hank Hansen.
Emailer writes, sis, Matt, could you ask Matt what he found most interesting, maybe something he didn't know that he learned throughout the course of the production?
For me, it was I drew a new appreciation for the nature of combat on Iwo Jima. It was really more brutal than I had ever imagined it. And having the opportunity to sit down and talk with Dave Severn and this other Marine that we identified, Ralph Pee Wee Griffith, having the opportunity to talk to those guys, in addition to all the other research, was enlightening. It made me look at combat and post-combat stress differently than perhaps I had before. I think that the comparison today is, Pee Wee Griffith was the second youngest guy in his squad, in his company, rather. He comes ashore on February 19th, and he's wounded on March 1st. So the sum total of his combat experience is less than 3 weeks. So he certainly says that, you know, he had bad dreams and stuff, but I think that, you know, while I'm not a doctor, from what I do know about post-traumatic stress, is I think that sustained and repeated injury is obviously plays a factor. And for Pee Wee, while he was in a slaughterhouse for 10 days, the sustained duration of what he was exposed to was not, say, what a Marine today might see in the course of 3 or 4 7-month combat tours.
I got another email question. Mac, did Doc Bradley ever write a statement saying that he was in the picture? Or was it just his Gagnon statements that he agreed to? And then I heard Lieutenant Colonel Morgan talk about him being greeted by the public affairs officer in D.C. when he showed up last week. Did he ever write a statement?
He did. And as you point out, he was told that he was in that photo from the very beginning. The Marine Corps issued a press release on April 8th, and Bradley was still in the hospital at this point when the release went out and they identified the flag raise. Initial identification went out without identifying where each man was in the photo. It was just the names of the men in the photo. So they brought the photo to Bradley. A nurse brought him the photo in the hospital, and they said, they say you're in this picture. And he couldn't pick himself out. Even James Bradley says that in the book. He could not pick himself out in the photo. So he doesn't know specifically where he is. And it's not until the 21st of April when he arrives in Washington and the lieutenant colonel meets him at the airport and points to the man number two to the right and says, this is you. So at that point, I don't know if John Bradley ever disputed his position. Like I said before, if he did, it's not inconceivable that the colonel told him something very much along the lines that he told Ira Hayes, which is, this is where you are, and you're going to hold that line. So that's apparently what Bradley did. Now, in 1946, when the commandant ordered an investigation into the identity of the flag raisers, Bradley did sign an affidavit or a statement that said, these are the names of the men in the photo. And he put himself in there. What I think is noteworthy about his statement, though, is that at first, he is adamant that Hank Hansen is, in fact, the man at the foot of the flagpole. He remembers, he says in a letter to DeVaye, I remember very well Hansen's parachute boots with the trousers tucked in the way he always wore them. You know, Hansen is noteworthy because he's got the parachute boots with the high ankles. Right. He's got his dungaree trousers tucked in. He's wearing his helmet without a cover. And that probably harkens back to the fact that he had come over from a parachute battalion when they dissolved them to form in part with Marine Division. Right. So it's notable that Bradley remembers or so adamant that Hank Hansen was there because Hank Hansen was standing right next to him when they raised the first flag. So that is an indication to me that at least up through 1946, Bradley probably believed to some degree that this was a photo of the flag raising that he had participated in. So, it may have been in later years that he began to question that, but it's unclear.
Right.
Regardless, I mean, we believe that if he was that going on the Bond tour was his top priority, then he probably held to that and did what he was told to do.
And I'm looking at the statement. It's dated October 3rd, 1946, to whom it may concern. In regards to the flag raising on Mount Suribachi, Iwo Jima, the men who were pictured in this photo are, in my estimation, Sergeant Henry Hansen, Sergeant Mike Strank, PFC Franklin Sousley, PFC Rennie Gagnon, Corporal Ira Hayes, and Farmerson Mate Second Class John H. Bradley, signed John H. Bradley. And witnessed by a captain by the name of McClure, United States Marine Corps in 1946. So, what's Matt, what's next on your project list? This is now come to market, and so what are you doing next?
My focus now is on a couple of scripted projects. One is a television series that will follow the effort to recover POWs and MIAs. A lot of people don't realize this, even within the military. There are 83,000 missing Americans, you know, missing in action, going all the way back to World War I through the Cold War. And there's one unit that is tasked with finding them. And so that is their mission. You know, they've got the most advanced forensic laboratory in the world is at Hickam Field in Hawaii.
Right.
And they do amazing work looking for lost service members. And the numbers are staggering that, you know, there were more than 2,000 naval aviators lost over Papua New Guinea alone in the battle for a ball.
2,000?
2,000. If you were an F-4U pilot, you might last 3 missions if you were lucky. So there's many, many of those guys lost that are in lagoons or in the jungles of Papua New Guinea.
Wow, that's a huge number. Holy smokes. Wow. And so that's what's coming up next?
That's my next effort. So working to get that made and continue to write. I continue to look to get projects made that really are, you know, they tend to be Marine-centric and are combat-centric, but I feel strongly that you know, we need to continue a movement in Hollywood. There's several Marines that are out working in the motion picture industry and or service members in the industry. And, you know, I look back at the days following World War II where the films about the wars were made by the men who had fought them. And I think it's very important that those veterans' voices show up in the arts, that we have the opportunity to get more veterans into the filmmaking process, because it makes for more honest depictions of the experience, I think.
Right,
I get very frustrated when I see the films that get made that depict the veterans as victims. I don't think any veteran, no matter what their struggles might be, would choose to portray themselves as a victim. Certainly not in the all-volunteer force. And I think it's essential that, you know, I listened a little bit to General Allen this weekend and then what you were playing beforehand. It's, you know, I have an 11-year-old son and a 6-year-old son, and it's something that's very difficult for me to imagine, is the notion of my sons fighting these same wars 10, 20 years from now. And that's exactly what he's describing. From my perspective, if we can at least move the population in some manner, through the arts, then I've at least done my part to contribute in a way that's meaningful, so that people really truly understand what it is we're up against. I can't tell you how, you know, living where I live and talking to people about the Iwo Jima project, it's staggering how many people have absolutely no awareness whatsoever of what Iwo even meant in the context of World War II, much less what it meant in the broader context of foray into war.
I want to say I'm surprised, but I'm not, and not in a bad way. You know, if you're not a history person, I mean, something that you know, I read about as a little kid, and you know, the advent of Google Earth, one of the first things I did was, what does it look like on Iwo Jima? And you know, just if you're not in that mindset, and the country's at war and you're at the mall, then I guess it wouldn't. Matt, what about, got an email. Mac, how do we contact Matt? Does he have a website? If we have questions and we're interested in getting into media and we'd like to talk to him, how do we do that? So is there a way people can contact you, Matt?
I don't have a website, but I guess I'm more than happy to share my email with this audience. Matthew.Morgan@hotmail.com.
That's an easy one.
Yeah, one of the things, though, and I would, I, you know, I talk to Sergeant Major Deaver about this frequently because he does. He has a website, which is oneforceinc.com. That's one, as in the number one, forceinc.com. And he, you know, he gets a lot of emails on that website, which is, you know, how do I become a military technical advisor? And his answer is always, don't become a military technical advisor. If you are interested in filmmaking, go to film school, because that's where you're going to have an impact on how films are made, what stories are told, and how they're told. One of the most infuriating things, and I've been blessed to have the opportunity to consult on several films, and they've been great experiences, but it's really very infuriating to be told that that doesn't matter, or the audience won't know. So what does it matter if we do it right or wrong anyway, or doing it that way is too hard? So it's much better to be in the position where you're one of the creatives, you know, in filmmaking terms, guiding the individual decisions about how a film gets made, rather than simply consulting on whether a rifle is correct or the uniforms look right. Because to large part, all that happens with that today is they'd much rather just have someone in wardrobe worry about uniforms, and most of the time they're going to get it wrong, but they really don't care. Very few filmmakers care to get it right. It's why you routinely will see TV shows where the soldiers are wearing their Manchurian collars on their ACUs up around their neck, because a costumer looks at that collar and just assumes that's the way it's fixed. Obviously, anybody that's been in the service knows that that's ridiculous. It's never worn that way. That's how it happens. You know, they don't take the time. They don't have the concern enough to make it right. So,
well, Matt, first of all, as a fellow Marine, congratulations on your documentary. Very proud of the quality of work you do, and also the way it was presented. It reframes not only the battle, but the valor and the brutality of that island, and it comes across in the production, as well as recognizing a Marine that never asked to be recognized in the most famous image and the icon of the Marine Corps. So congratulations, and thank you for coming on again today, and I hope you don't mind on occasion if we bug you and bring you back on and talk to you about whatever we feel like talking about.
Sure, that'd be fantastic. I've become a new fan of the show, and I look forward to any opportunity to come back on and talk about whatever.
All right. Well, Matt, again, I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
There you go. Matt Morgan, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps. Breaking news. The FBI recommends no charges against Hillary Clinton in the email probe. How about that? No charges. Well, good for her. We're going to talk to Jerry Durant. He's a retired Marine colonel and a Vietnam veteran. You're not going to meet too many with his background. And he's a battle buddy from Afghanistan, from Iraq in 2004. So we're going to talk to him. We're a little bit late. That coming up next right here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.